One of the tests of a good organization is when the second string is thoroughly competent. When you can bring somebody in off the bench and the team doesn't lose a step, that's good. This is still Thursday. It's still the 18th of August, 2005. We're still at the Freiburg New Church Assembly. I am no longer F. Bob Toffel, however. I'm George Dole. We're still on the theme of charity, and my title is Be Careful. There is a Latin word, caritas, spelled C-H-A-R-I-T-A-S, and it does look a lot like the English word charity. Looks can be deceiving, but if you think they're always deceiving, they may fool you. Charity is a very common word in the published theological works. It does occur 6,658 times. Now take that down. Okay. So it would be a good idea to translate it as accurately as we can. And this is going to be kind of a look into the arcane world of translating. It's a two-step process. Step one is to figure out what the word means, which may vary and often does depending on context. And step two is to figure out what word or words to use and what words to use in what sequence in order to convey that meaning. So taking step one first, how do we figure out what caritas means? Well, we can look it up in the dictionary, but that is actually going at things backward because the dictionary bases its definitions on usage. I've had a couple of instances lately where my consultant has objected to something I proposed because she couldn't find that meaning in her dictionary. Matter of fact, she was looking in the wrong dictionary, but that's another point. The problem was that none of the meanings she could find made sense in the context of the passage, which left us with two possibilities. Either Swedenborg had simply used a wrong word, or the dictionary had missed something, and dictionaries sometimes do. You may recall, some of you were here last week, I read a series of definitions of the word of from a dictionary, and they left out the meaning belonging to, which is one of the most common meanings of all. Well, since the final authority for determining the meaning of a word is usage, in order to be absolutely secure of the meaning of caritas in the theological works, it would be necessary to go through all 6,658 instances and see what worked in each instance. But since we'd like to finish our share of the NCE within our lifetimes, hopefully within the next decade or so, we don't go to such extremes. We don't even go very close to such extremes. But what we do is keep our eyes peeled for passages that give clues about meaning, passages where the context sends unusually clear signals, and thanks to email, we share these with each other with considerable regularity. We do go to dictionaries because lexicographers, dictionary writers, have looked at a lot of instances, and because the good dictionaries or lexicons give instances of various usages. But in fact, good lexicographers will sometimes miss usages, and they'll be grateful to you if you call their attention to a usage they've missed. This is the spice of lexicographical life. They, aha, wow. So what I'd like to do this morning is look at what caritas may mean in a few passages that I've found particularly instructive, and then explore what they may imply for translation. And during the discussion of step one, I will pretty much be using charity as the equivalent of caritas. During the discussion of step two, I'll bring up some of the assets and liabilities of this and some other possible translations. One of the passages that gives a fairly obvious clue as to the meaning of caritas is TCR 142, where Swedenborg tells us that it is no different from bonitas, or goodness. This doesn't mean that the two words are synonyms, because it could well mean that charity is simply a subset of a particular kind of goodness. But it interests me largely because of the similarity in form between caritas and bonitas. These nouns that end in itas are all names of qualities derived from related adjectives. Bonus means good, bonitas means goodness. And they're ancestors of our words that end in ity, which work in the same way. Sincerity is the quality denoted by the adjective sincere. Rapidity, the quality denoted by the adjective rapid. Stupidity for stupid, so on and so forth. And at least in context of TCR 142, then, caritas denotes a quality. There is a related adjective. I'm saving that for a little later. But there's a second passage that seems to, at first sight, to challenge this. It's one of my old favorites, number 100 of New Jerusalem, its heavenly teachings, and it's one of my favorites partly because 100 is such an easy number to remember. And I quote, "Many people think that love of the neighbor is giving to the poor, providing resources to the needy, doing good to everyone, but charity is acting prudently and with the goal of having something good come of it." Close quote. And this reads like a definition. This is what charity is. If so, charity is not the quality of the deed, but the deed itself, the doing. But we're cautioned against any such relatively literal reading by that previous clause, that people think that love of the neighbor is giving to the poor. Because strictly speaking, giving may be one of the things that love does, but it isn't love itself. So I find this little passage making two significant contributions to the effort to determine the meaning of caritas. First, it equates it with love of the neighbor. Many people think love of the neighbor is this, but charity is this. This doesn't say, but love of the neighbor is. He says, but charity is. And second, it tells us about its quality by telling what it does. You will know them by their fruits. The quality of caritas then includes prudence, which is a careful calculation of the probable effects of our words or deeds, and it includes good intent, bonitas, goodness, if you will. Now I want to back up a little at this point and draw a distinction between words used as words and words used as terms. This is what I anticipated a couple of days ago in the course of responding to one of the lecturers. I see a word used as a term designed to have one meaning and one meaning only. It's defined by its boundaries, so to speak. Any creature that does not have a spine is not a vertebrate. And any creature that does have a spine is a vertebrate. And it's an on-off switch. There's no blur between. Any substance that does not flow is not a liquid. There isn't an overlap there. But a word used as a word will have a range of meanings. And it can be thought of as defined not by its boundaries, but by its center. It can be used literally or poetically. For example, we can speak of a light soufflé, a light cavalry, or light verse. And there is a central notion that runs through these three usages, but no single definition is likely to work equally well in all of them. And words overlap all over the map. A light soufflé is also a successful soufflé. This is necessary because experience never repeats itself precisely. We always need to modify things. This is a beautiful day. It's not like any other beautiful day that ever was. And I hasten to say, though, that although words may overlap, and though the edges of a word's meaning, the boundaries, may be very hard to locate, the center can be very precise. We struggle sometimes to find exactly the right word, and every once in a while, we hit it, and we know it. A sentence by a British author named Terry Pratchett comes to mind. He's describing what it feels like when you're stuck listening to someone ramble on disjointedly about their states of mind. And his sentence is, "When you're a cork in another person's stream of consciousness, all you can do is spin and bob in the eddies." I think that's a gorgeous image. Yeah. So there is, in a word, a central notion, and quite possibly a very precise one. a central notion and a precise one that runs through love of the neighbor and acting prudently with the goal of having something good come of it, a central notion to this word caritas. And these two phrases indicate that that central notion has to do with intelligent, genuine concern for other persons. And there's support for this further along in NJHD section 108, which offers a clue of a different sort. Again, I quote, "There is no way we can know what faith is in its essence unless we know what charity is, since where there is no charity, there is no faith. That is, charity is inseparable from faith, the way what is good is inseparable from what is true. What we love or hold dear is what we regard as good, and what we believe is what we regard as true. This shows that the oneness of charity and faith is like that of what is good and what is true," close quote. Well, to say that faith and charity are inseparable is to say that charity necessarily engages the mind as well as the heart. The thought that charity is essential to the faith, which is the main point of this citation, is too big a topic to handle unless we give a week to it, at least. But for the clue of a different sort, I need to skip ahead to step two, translation, because there is a logic to this little passage that is just about completely lost in the translation I offered. I mentioned earlier that there is an adjective associated with caritas, the way bonus is associated with bonitas, and here it is. It's the adjective caros, meaning dear. And to make the connection with caritas clear, Swedenborg here doesn't spell it C-A-R-U-S, which is the usual spelling, but C-H-A-R-U-S, like C-H-A-R-I-T-A-S. So to make the connection with caritas clear, we'd say at this point, Swedenborg is saying caritas means dearness. The adjective is dear. The quality, name of the quality is dearness. So we would capture the logic by translating, and this would be quite literally, literal. There is no way we can know what faith is in its essence unless we know what dearness is, since where there is no dearness, there is no faith. That is, dearness is inseparable from faith, the way what is good is inseparable from what is true. What we love or hold dear is what we regard as good, and what we believe is what we regard as true. This shows that the oneness of dearness and faith is like that of what is good and what is true. And that captures the logic, but it loses a lot in terms of meaning, and it loses any connection with, hey, you know, we're talking about charity here. And what I'd suggest is that by connecting caritas with caros, with dear, in this passage, Swedenborg is saying not that it means dearness, but that essential to charity is a consciousness of the dearness of others, that it means essentially a sense of dearness, a feeling of dearness. We love people when they are dear to us. I have charity when and only when others are dear to me. And we might get both the logic and the meaning with something like this. There is no way we can know what faith is in its essence unless we know what it is to treasure each other. Since where there is no such treasuring, there is no faith. That is, treasuring is inseparable from faith, the way what is good is inseparable from what is true. What we love or treasure is what we regard as good, and what we believe is what we regard as true, which shows us that the oneness of treasuring and faith is like that of what is good and what is true, close quote. And again, the problem with this is that unless we went through the rest of the theological works and revised the translations of caritas accordingly, and it probably wouldn't work well in a lot of passages, the reader would never guess that we're talking about what is elsewhere known as charity. And translators are all too often faced with choices between consistency and fidelity to context, and something has to give, and the result will inevitably feel like a reluctant compromise. A fourth passage that may serve as a representative of what is arguably the most common usage of caritas. It's from Heavenly Secrets 161, and says of any action that unless there is charity in it, or love and faith, and the Lord within them, the action is not one that can be called a work of charity or the fruit of faith, close quote. And here charity clearly is not the action itself, not just the motive of the action, it is both the motive and the intelligence, love and faith, and it is embodied in action. The whole trio is present and accounted for. Well, there are 6,683, I think, other instances of caritas, but this will have to do for the exploration of meaning, and I hope it makes it clear that we're dealing with a range of meaning. And I hope also that the center of that range is pretty clearly located somewhere in the area of a combination of genuine, honest love and prudence. So turning to step two, translation, the obvious place to begin is with the English lookalike charity. And the two resources we have here are the same two that we have in for the Latin term, our usage, our own experiences with the word, and our dictionary, our dear old friend, the dictionary. And since we don't have time to share our experiences of usage, we turn perforce to the dictionary. The one at hand, as I wrote, starts by saying charity, noun. Okay, that's so far so good. Then we have a series of definitions listed in order of frequency. One, the voluntary provision of money, materials, or help to people in need. Now this, you know, we've been over some of this before, but repetition is the key to good teaching. Repetition is the key to good teaching. That is one form of good behavior, surely, but it isn't goodness itself, providing money. It also is, again, an action rather than a quality. Two, money, materials, or help voluntarily given to people in need. Again, closely connected, but goodness is a quality rather than a bunch of stuff. Three, an organization that collects money and other voluntary contributions of help for people in need. And again, we trust such organizations are characterized by goodness, but that is the quality, the distinction between the quality and what embodies it. Four, the willingness to judge people in a tolerant or favorable way, which is getting closer. For one thing, willingness is a quality, like goodness. But the restriction to judging reduces this to a subcategory of what Swedenborg means by charity, caritas. And fifth, the impartial love of other people, which is getting pretty close, real promise, especially given the equation noted between charity and love of the neighbor. Well, there are two problems. One, it's the fifth meaning rather than the first, and it doesn't really catch the notion of prudence very carefully, because caritas isn't exactly the same as impartiality. It isn't always being equally nice to everyone. If impartial means not favoring one side, one person more than another, then there's a significant sense in which caritas is not impartial. Given an issue with two clear sides, it will try to discern which is the more promising, and it will favor that over the other. Then, too, there is a tendency throughout, especially in the early definitions, to restrict the objects of charity to those in need, but we're all in need to some extent. And the picture implied by the definition is of people who are not in need giving to people who are. And in this connection, that is just what number 100 of NJHD rejects. Many people think that love of the neighbor is giving to the poor and providing resources to the needy. That is, many people buy into something that isn't what Swedenborg means by caritas. So what we need as translators would seem to be an English word that means the quality of heart and mind that prompts us to act prudently and to the end that something good will come of what we do. That's a little bit long, to plug in every time you run across the word caritas. So at this point, I need to turn back to the difference between words used as words and words used as terms. Terms, by their very nature, need to have exact equivalents in other languages. The English word osteoporosis needs to have an exact equivalent in French, Arabic, German, Polish, Russian, and so on, for example, if medical knowledge is to be shared. Words don't work that way. In fact, it's rare that two words in different languages will have exactly the same meaning ranges, two words used as words. We might think that the English word cabbage means the same as the French word chou, and used as a term, as a name of a specific vegetable, it presumably does, but we do not express affection for someone by calling her a little cabbage. We don't use it that way. If we think of a word then as primarily defined by its central meaning, we can visualize its range as surrounding concentric circles, larger or smaller, depending on the word in question. And the more closely the center of an English word coincides with the center of a Latin word, the more consistently we'll be able to use that word in translation. But to the extent that the centers don't coincide, there'll be part of the meaning range of the Latin word that lies outside the range of the English word. And that blank will fall within the meaning range of another English word or other English words, since one way or another, languages tend to cover the field. And when all else falls, of course, we can fall back on words that have immense meaning ranges, words like something or whatever. Now, I've gone around in a number of circles when it comes to translating caritas, and consistency is a genuine value. To lose connection with the long history of such phrases as faith, hope, and charity is a significant loss. But sometimes there can be such an immense discrepancy between history and meaning that the pressure toward change is immense. And I have a favorite example. The central meaning of the Greek word diatheke is covenant. It's one of its extended meanings, which is pretty obvious when you come to think of it, is the covenant by which one mandates the distribution of one's assets to one's heirs, namely, one's last will and testament. And the closest equivalent to this in Latin is testamentum, which looks very much like the English word testament. And the result is that the Greek phrases, meaning the old covenant and the new covenant, have found their way into English as the Old Testament and the New Testament. Now, I suspect that if you asked Christians what the word testament means, 9 out of 10 would say, oh, it means part of the Bible. And not many of the ones left over would say that it means a covenant. Now, I don't think charity is anywhere near as misleading as covenant, but I hope the comparison of Latin contextual meanings and the English dictionary definitions does demonstrate that the centers aren't in the same place, that the meaning ranges do not coincide. And English does have other words of related meaning. One of the candidates that appeals to me very strongly is the word thoughtfulness. And meaning number one for the word thoughtful in one dictionary is, quote, treating people in a kind and considerate way, especially by anticipating their wants and needs. So this seems to me to include both the feeling and the thinking. And for me at least, and I think commonly, the adjective thoughtful has nothing to do with intellectualism. When I say that was thoughtful of you, I'm recognizing that you cared, yes, and that you cared enough to try to understand, to think what was needed, what I needed, and to supply it. And that in itself, that last little sentence, brings three other candidates into the arena: kindness, considerateness, and caring. Considerateness is not at all bad, technically very defensible, but stylistically it's clumsy. Kindness is quite appropriate on the feeling side, but in my estimation, less so on the thinking side. In the definition just cited, the lexicographer felt it necessary to say kind and considerate, presumably because of a feeling that kind didn't sufficiently convey considerate all by itself. Kindly feelings may prompt us to loan money to a friend who we strongly suspect will misuse it. And it shares that risk particularly with charity in its English words, which can readily suggest being uncritical. And the third, caring, actually has one feature that ought to recommend it to traditionalists, namely that it is derived from that adjective charis, meaning dear. Caring does signal the involvement of both the head and the heart very often. The heart perhaps most obviously, but the head very clearly when we think of what it means to take care or to be, as my title said, careful. But sadly, that word careful has gravitated so far toward cautious. It would be convenient if it suggested looking to see the best as well as looking to avoid the worst, if careful meant full of caring. And the other liability of caring as a translation for caritas is essentially stylistic. It's one of those words that's overused, and when that happens to a word, it tends to lose its force and precision. It becomes a truism. The advertising industry is constantly faced with this kind of erosion of meaning, and therefore is constantly looking for new superlatives, or bigger ways to display the word new and improved. We find ourselves saying things like real caring because we want people to think of what the word means. My favorite Latin professor used to talk about the natural depravity of language, and it's a constant danger. Words that are overused lose force. And the word care itself deteriorates in another way because in many contexts it means something like a burden. When we talk of people being weighed down by their cares, the cares and troubles of this world. So the translator is faced with a choice among compromises. I'm no stranger to the tendency to fall in love with one particular solution, especially if it's mine, if nobody else came up with it first. But I've also had the experience of falling out of love with such finds, and I actually think that's more fun. I find it preferable. Be that as it may, the reader then is faced with the task of trying to discern the particular meaning that the translator was trying to convey. And here, I am coming to believe that we are truly blessed by Swedenborg's repetitiveness, because I'm convinced that there's no way every sentence can be translated in such a way as to preclude misunderstanding. And I'm also convinced that the cumulative effect of reading is to keep nudging misunderstandings off to the side. So the principle I would urge is to let go of anything, any feeling that things are true because Swedenborg says so, and to assume the opposite, namely that Swedenborg says things because they're true, which may help us to keep trying to look through the words on the page and see the reality that they're talking about, which is, I trust, the reality of our own lives and our own relationships. The floor is yours.
Being a sometime translator myself, I can appreciate your talk. Mm-hmm. And I should give a disclaimer at the beginning, and that is that I actually used one of your words most commonly in translating caritas, namely kindness, in my Heavenly City translation. Thinking about the idea of Swedenborg defining his own terms, I suspect he less defines than he does try to give you an idea of what they really are. And I suspect that in Latin, the word caritas doesn't imply necessarily thoughtfulness in its native meanings. It doesn't imply that you're thinking with prudence to do good, but probably has a similar meaning to what we talk about, love or kindness. And therefore, Swedenborg has to explain that it does actually involve your mind. If the Latin word were to have that built right into it, he wouldn't have to explain it by saying that your mind has to be involved. And I don't think I thought that very clearly when I was doing the translation itself, but I suspect that even if we don't manage to find an English word that encompasses all that Swedenborg says is implied or inherent in a word, we're still translating the Latin, and we still need his explanation of what it really is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd like to hitchhike on, go back to one thing you said earlier about this that first substantive chapter of NJHD, where he says nothing is more important than to know what good and truth are and how they relate to each other, and then doesn't define either. And I think his focus on the relationship between the two, the net effect of that is to say they are indefinable apart from their relationship to each other, that they are defined by that relationship, and that nothing is true unless it shows us what is good, and that nothing is good for us unless it opens us to accept what is true, to see things truly, which is very different from a strictly cognitive definition of truth, and it's a sneaky one.
Could you repeat what you just said?
I wasn't listening. I'll try, but I can try. That in that first substantive section, chapter let of NJHD, when he says that nothing is more important than to know what good and truth are and to know how they relate, and then failing to offer a definition, in a sense, by implication, he says that they define each other, and that nothing is good for us unless it opens us to see things truly, ourselves and others, and that nothing is true unless it shows us what is good. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think Dave has the mic.
Yes, this is something I was going to ask you or one of the other translators privately, but when you said Swedenborg says it because it's true, I thought it might be nice to bring it up now. I'm reading the King James Version and the version that Swedenborg used in Revelation 6:6. It says, a measure of wheat for a penny and three measures of barley for a penny, and he says that's because they hold goodness and truth in such little disregard, while the NIV and New Revised Standard Version say it's a denarius, which is a full day's wage, which would imply they hold it in high regard. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, hopefully that's one case out of his whole writings, but I was curious how that works, that he wasn't guided to say, oh no, it actually means a lot of good and truth.
One of the difficulties traditionally with the church is drawing the line between what is divine and between the revelatory content and the accommodation, the way in which that is communicated, the line between the divine and human contributions to the theological works themselves. And there has been a tendency in the church, understandable but I think regrettable, to think that the more you minimize the human content, the more you enhance the value, its value or its status as revelation. And I simply don't think that is true. It makes a difference in the form and how you read it, but my favorite example is that the only example in Scripture of unmediated divine revelation is the first set of the Ten Commandments. God cut out some tablets. God wrote some words on them. All Moses had to do, didn't have anything to do with the giving. He just had to carry it down to ground level, and he blew it. He broke them. So the second time, God says, okay, this time you cut out the tablets. And all Moses had to do, that's a minimal job. God still wrote the words. But Swedenborg uses that as an illustration of the fact that there is always a human component to revelation. It's never unmediated. And then I contrast that with the opening of the Gospel of Luke, where Luke says, you know, there are all these stories circulating about this Jesus of Nazareth. And since I understand everything perfectly, and from the beginning I thought it was about time I wrote this down and set everybody straight. That's different. And both are part of sacred scripture. But they're very different in the way in which they were delivered. And I think we need to look at our theological works with as little bias as we can about how much of this is 18th century context and how much of this is revelatory, and try to see through the one, adjust, adapt to the one, allow for it in order to see the other more clearly.
I have a bunch of passages in to the Bible and Swedenborg, and just pithy sayings I want to remember. And to this of Madison in the Federalist 37, when the Almighty himself condescends to address mankind in their own language, his meaning, luminous as it must be, is rendered dim and doubtful by the cloudy medium through which it is communicated.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish I had said that.
You did.
Your talk brings to mind the contemporary of Swedenborg, Carl von Linnaeus, who was busy trying to sort out the chaos of the plant world and how to describe it in a precise and meaningful way. And he came up with a brilliant system of describing it in terms rather than words,
yeah,
with the genus, the family, the species, the cultivar. Mm-hmm. And this was an incredible improvement over what had gone before to avoid confusion. And it has worked beautifully amongst every language. Latin is the medium by which different peoples can be talking about exactly, precisely the same plant. However, botanists get in the way and they keep reclassifying things, so even terms aren't completely immutable in terms of their longevity.
Yeah. 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 And Lee had his hand up again. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Going back to goodness and truth, and relating that to what I said earlier about Swedenborg and definitions, I suspect that he isn't really even intending to define them for us. He's saying, this is important for you to figure out, and I'm going to give you some pointers as to what directions you might try going to figure this out. I think he's giving us marching orders, not giving us definitions. He's saying to us, nothing's more important than knowing what good and truth is, therefore you better spend your life doing that. And you may look in these directions. It's similar to your will and your understanding. What do you love and what do you understand? That gives you some experiential knowledge of what goodness and truth are. Now work on it.
Mm-hmm. I quite agree. And also, I mentioned earlier in the week, he has some scathing things about people who start with terms instead of moving from thought to terms, who move from terms to thought. Very did not want to build a terminological system, so to speak. And I think the church has, in its more academic forms, has tended to go turn the wrong way on the Aristotelian road and try to build terminological systems.
Just one comment on using the word prudence as part of the definition of charity. Mm-hmm. I've been turning that over in my mind for the last half an hour. Mm-hmm. And I also heard you retell the joke about the anecdote, it's not a joke at all, of the doctor on the hospital ship off the coast of, I guess it was Sumatra after the tsunami, and how he felt wonderful, proud of his country. And I haven't had a lot of money to give, but I felt compelled to give money after the tsunami. And part of good charity these days in the form of money given to an organization that is, you know, ostensibly charged with helping those in need is exercising prudence and choosing that organization very carefully. And how do you measure that? Yeah. Well, you try to come up with some measure of how much of one's dollar, how many cents on the dollar actually reach the people that the money isn't intended to help. So yeah. Prudence in a very practical sense has become part of the definition of charity in noun form, yeah. I think, in modern society.
Yeah, very much so. And some of the, quote, charities that solicit money not very much filters through to the supposed intended recipients. I too believe in the diversions of charity. I didn't mention them, but see no reason why we couldn't adjourn. So thank you.